Thursday, June 6th, 1946. Chateau St. Ulrich, Gallia. Wilma Bishop had spent the last several weeks getting her air legs back, flying at every opportunity she could grab. She still stopped in at Zauberschule about one day in three, but the others didn't begrudge her attendance. They knew how important that time was for Wilma. Today, however, she hadn't tried to tag along with the morning patrol, or used an excuse to borrow someone else's striker to go for a training flight with Chris Barkhorn, who was soon to graduate to what Wilma jokingly referred to as a big girl striker herself. Instead, she was in fuel storage, along with Ursula Hartmann. "You know," the Karlslander said slowly, "when you originally offered, I thought you were joking." Wilma shook her head. "No, I was dead serious. You have a striker here that needs tested. I want to give it a shot. You're just about ready, aren't you?" Ursula nodded, still obviously considering what the older witch had said. "I am, yes. I've done bench tests on the ether jets and control surfaces. The next step would be flight trials." She walked to the spare launch stage where the red and orange prototype sat waiting. "It's an experimental craft, and that means things are almost guaranteed to go wrong. On top of that, it's not going to fly like any striker you've ever used, and there's a good chance that the learning curve is going to be very, very steep." Turning back to face Wilma, she took off her glasses to make better eye contact. "Last but not least, there is the propulsion. I am fairly certain that I've solved the problems that made the ME-262-V1 so dangerous. But the only way to know that for sure is to fly it. And if I am wrong, this striker could kill you." Wilma didn't want to laugh. Hartmann was clearly very serious and very concerned. But she did give the younger woman a small smile. "Seems to me that's a risk most test pilots take on anyway." Ursula replaced her glasses and offered a matching smile. "There is that. More practically, have you been getting flight time with more powerful strikers?" "Yep," Wilma answered. "I'm current again on the Mark 22 Spitfire, and I've gotten check rides in the FW-190 and BF-109. Even talked Bear Girl into letting me borrow her 40Q yesterday."
"And how did that go?"
Wilma smirked. "Well, I'm still here, and she's not trying to feed me to Wojtek." That got a laugh out of the normally more reserved Hartmann twin, who seemed to relax a bit.
"All right, Sergeant Bishop. Consider yourself assigned to the 404th.
Blinking, as if something had just occurred to her, Ursula reached into her lab coat and pulled out a small notepad and pencil.
"I suppose this means that we'll need to have Rittmeister von Hammer fill out some paperwork."
Wilma shrugged. "Technically, I'm already a consultant, right? So let's consult." A few hours of reading and a break for lunch later, the two witches stood atop the launch stages. Ursula's loaded with her FW-190, while Wilma stood atop the HA-162's platform.
"I'll be your chase pilot for this one," Ursula explained. "If anything should go wrong, it means I'll be there to help. Ideally, later on, we'll be able to ask some of the others to take care of that, and I can be on the ground to monitor the test telemetry."
Wilma nodded, giving the jet striker one last look before stepping to the edge of the stage. "Well, we're not going to get anywhere just standing around, right?" The Karlslander nodded, then stepped off her launch stage, energizing the striker's Miyafuji engine and preparing for launch. Once her etheric propellers had spun up, she looked over and nodded. Wilma took a deep breath, released it slowly, then let herself fall into the HA-162's embrace.
opening herself to the Force almost as automatically as she'd once released her internal magical energies. She felt the jet's Miyafuji engine engage, but instead of the usual throaty rumble of a piston engine, she heard the etherjet turbines beneath her spinning up with a whine that rapidly came up in pitch. Even in the launch stage, it felt a bit slippery, she supposed. The jet exhaust pushed against the ground in a totally different way than she was used to, but she'd known this would be a very different experience. After satisfying herself that it wasn't going to get away from her before she'd even left the hangar, Wilma gave Ursula a nod of her own, then activated her radio. St. Ulrich Tower, this is Whiskey Kilo 2-8 requesting launch clearance for evaluation flight. Wilma was mildly surprised, but the voice that replied from the tower was that of Hannelore von Hammer herself. Roger, Whiskey Kilo 2-8, you're clear to launch. Halsund Beinbruch. Wilma released the launch stage's interlocks, and the Stryker leapt from the stage even faster than she'd expected, bursting out of the hangar and into the sky in a heartbeat.
Yahoo!
Flying Yak Studios and Bacon Comics Group, in association with the International Police Organization and Avalon Broadcasting System, present Lensman the Brave and the Bold, Our Witches at War, Another Serial Experiment, Episode 14, Contact. After the rush of takeoff, Wilma did her best to settle down and concentrate, leveling off at 15,000 feet and waiting for Ursula to join her after a slightly more sedate launch. Pulling alongside so she could speak without needing the radio, Ursula gave a broad smile. Wilma suspected it was as much for seeing her creation finally in the air as it was for her. Well, I can see that takeoff and climb are not issues for you. How does it feel? Wilma grinned back. Incredible. When I opened her up, it was like someone shot me out of a cannon. Pulling a slow turn around the Karlslander, Wilma gave the Stryker a bit more thought. You were right about it being a bit of a handful, though. Powering up was a lot different, and it's almost a little too quick to respond when I put some rudder on. Twitchy. Ursula nodded, and Wilma could almost see the notes she was writing in her head. That's good to know. Do you feel comfortable attempting maneuvers? I think so, Wilma said after giving a moment's consideration. What would you like me to try first? Let's start with something simple. This flight is mostly to start defining the Stryker's envelope. Give some banking turns a try? Wilma opened up a bit of space, not trying to go up to full throttle just yet, and began a series of wide turns. Good, Hartman called. Now perform some coordination tests, please. What are those when they're at home? Try a 45-degree banked roll to the left, then back to level flight, and then repeat to the right. Oh, gotcha. Wilma began to execute the roll, then felt the slipping sensation again. The whole rudder was trying to push over rather than let her level out. Gritting her teeth, she pulled it back, but lost control briefly when she tried to reverse the maneuver to the right, going into a brief spin before she pulled things back together. Wilma, are you all right?
I think so.
I tried to keep the rudder in line, but it blew over on me. I saw. I think I'm going to have to make a few changes to the configuration to help compensate for that. Do you think you can continue? Long as I'm careful, sure. I'll need to watch my pitch angle. Two very productive and occasionally hair-raising hours later, the two women brought their Strykers back to the castle, Ursula with a number of notes and potential modifications to review, Wilma feeling exultant but badly in need of a shower. To their surprise, when the two women taxied back toward the launch stages closest to fuel storage, there was a truck in RAF livery sitting next to the open doors, with a couple of enlisted technicians unloading crates from the rear of the bed. Farther forward, a tarpaulin obscured a larger object lashed to the bulkhead at the back of the cab. Wilma looked Ursula in surprise. "That's an Austin K4 lorry. Were you expecting any deliveries?" The Carlslander shook her head, heading to her launch stage. "We'd better find out what's going on." As they docked and powered down, the Austin's cab opened, and a woman in her late 20s leapt down, crossing the hangar floor at a reasonably quick pace. Like the truck, she was dressed in an RAF uniform, wearing the rank slides of a group captain, in fact, with dark brown hair that appeared almost black, pulled back and pinned up into a bun. Based on her lack of trousers, below her blue serge uniform blouse, which was worn open over cardigan and dress shirt, she wore only black tights. Ursula and Wilma assumed that she was, or had been, a witch. "Carefully, gentlemen, if you please," she said, addressing the technicians who were unloading the truck. "I expect most of that equipment will be broken," she added with a wry smile, "but I should prefer to do it in testing." Stepping back into her boots, Wilma wasn't sure if she was actually supposed to salute the new arrival or not, since she'd technically become a consultant rather than having her enlistment reactivated. But their visitor took matters into her own hands by approaching to within about 3 feet of the launch stage and locking on to Ursula.
"You Hartman, commander of the 404th Test Squadron?"
Ursula nodded, stepping down off her launch stage and pulling her lab coat on from where she'd left it hanging over one of the side rails.
"Yes, I am Ursula Hartman, group captain."
"Same Hartman that was with KG-200.
"Yes."
"And worked on the 262 project for Messerschmitt."
Ursula looked a bit awkward.
"That's technically classified information."
The Britannian woman snorted.
"Doesn't matter, love. I'm cleared for it, since you've been playing with my toys this entire time without asking."
Ursula's face took on a look somewhere between utter confusion and rather wounded dignity.
"I do beg your pardon."
"Group Captain Francis Whittle, RAF. Among other things, I'm the woman who's been working on centrifugal turbo ether jet propulsion since 1937.
Surprisingly, that claim actually made Ursula relax slightly.
"Ah, I believe I take your meaning now.
However, the designs that we've been using were entirely Carlslandic in origin. Dr. Hans von Ohain at the RLM, the Imperial Aviation Ministry, in Brandenburg created the basic engine designs, which I helped refine and adapt. I assure you, we never knew that anyone in Britannia was working along the same lines."
Whittle's somewhat severe look softened a bit.
"Really? Fascinating. I'll have to meet this doctor of yours, though I may give him a bit of a wallop regardless."
Finally smiling at the two witches, she gave a closer look at the HA-162 in its launch stage.
"So, is this the new jet unit I heard was being tested here?"
Ursula nodded, walking over to the stage.
"Yes, it's my own design, including some refinements to the BMW engines that were originally meant for the ME-262A1 before they ran into manufacturing delays."
Whittle moved in, running a hand over one of the unit's fuselages.
"Magnificent."
"Thank you.
But it looks to me like you're in for a bit of a wild ride with that rudder arrangement,"
Whittle went on, eyeing the unit's control surfaces.
"So Sergeant Bishop just learned," Ursula admitted. "I think I have a few ideas on how to refine the control surfaces to improve that."
"Bishop?" Whittle looked over, as if just realizing that another woman had, in fact, been standing there this whole time.
"You're no Carlslander with that name. Or that jacket."
Wilma shook her head, offering a hand.
Wilma Bishop. I used to fly for the Royal Faraway Land Air Force. Came out of retirement to test for Captain Hartman.
Whittle looked intrigued as she shook hands.
Well, nice to meet you, Wilma. Call me Francie.
Turning back to Ursula, she flipped a thumb over to point at the truck.
Anyway, I decided to bring you something, since I thought you'd already raided the rest of my team's closet.
Turning, she walked back to the side of the cargo bed, then loosened the ties on the corner of the tarp before yanking it backwards to reveal a Stryker unit in its launch stage, painted in the light blue and dark green camouflage of an RAF fighter, and sporting the distinctive pod of a jet engine set into the middle of each of the unit's winglets. Much as Whittle had with the HA-162, Ursula stepped forward and gently ran her fingers down an engine's fairing.
This is beautiful work. Is it ready to fly?
Whittle smiled like a proud mother.
Thank you, Captain Hartman. It's ready to be tested, at least. Originally, I'd planned to deliver it to Boscombe Down, but when word came back that 404 Squadron was doing work with jet strikers on the front lines, I decided it was worth bringing it here.
Pulling the tarp back further, she gestured to several crates that had been tied down to the Austin's bed.
Spare parts, including two complete replacement engines from Rolls-Royce, just in case. Armament is two sets of paired Hispano 20mm cannons, one for each hand with 2,000 rounds between them.
Turning back, she gave both witches a moment to take that on board, then finished her presentation with a bit of a flourish.
We call it the Meteor.
Wilma whistled appreciatively.
That is a real piece of work. Planning to stick around to see how it does?
Whittle shook her head.
Much as I'd love to, I'm still doing a fair bit of development work back at Lutterworth. Technically, I shouldn't even be here, but I couldn't resist. I can give you a week, maybe two, to help get the testing program started, but after that, I need to get back to the shed.
Hours. Route D-37, near Gutzenbrook, Gallia. Phyllis Schwartz stood by the side of the road, glowering at her truck. Of all the times to get a puncture, when she was running late on the return trip of an errand she hadn't wanted to run in the first place. The woods of Moselle weren't as dangerous as, for instance, the banks of the Rhine, but all the same, Fee could think of many places she'd prefer to be than stranded halfway between Beech and Lichtenberg with night coming on. She decided she had better try and change the wheel while she still had a bit of daylight to work with. Sunset this time of year was around 8:30 in the evening, but in these woods it was already getting dark. Grumbling, she went to the cab of the truck and folded the seat forward, got out the tire iron and loosened the lug nuts, inwardly cursing whatever engineer at Opel had decided each wheel should have 8 of the damn things. Carlslanders. Always over-designing things. Once she had them loose, she wrestled the spare tire out of its bracket underneath the truck bed, rolled it over so that it would be ready to hand, then went back to the cab for the jack, and discovered that it wasn't there. Letting out a growl, she considered hurling the tire iron into the woods, but controlled herself. She'd just have to go and find it if she did that anyway. Putting it away instead, she sighed and resigned herself to walking back up the road to Gutzenbrook. From there, she'd be able to telephone Lichtenberg and request assistance, albeit at the cost of hours of kidding about having forgotten her radio. Suddenly, Fee stiffened, her magic twinging as she became aware of her presence behind her. Involuntarily, she manifested the distinctive features of her familiar. Her thick, grayish hair thickened further, becoming a jagged sheaf of thorny spines that, in her agitation, bristled up and outward in all directions, as a short, thick tail covered in the same dropped from the hem of her Royal Faraway Land Air Force uniform blouse. She turned slowly around, unfastening the flap of her sidearm holster as she did so,
and when she saw what had triggered her magic, she yanked the pistol from its holster and thrust it straight out, her thumb automatically drawing back the hammer. A half dozen yards or so away, a few paces beyond the front of the truck, a figure shaped like a witch with a striker unit stood, well, hovered, regarding her. In the fading daylight, its surface was an oddly iridescent black, glinting with strange highlights as the sun's last rays filtered through the trees off to the side of the road and played on the unmistakable glossy hide of a Niroi.
"Don't you move," Fee said, her voice low. She wasn't sure her Webley would actually do anything against a Niroi, even one as small as this one, but she preferred to believe it would. Keeping the other figure covered, she advanced slowly until she stood next to the damaged wheel, then halted, aiming the revolver at the blank space where the faux witch's face would be. The Niroi witch took no hostile action. Instead, it tilted its head in a manner that would have conveyed puzzlement in a human, and then, to Fee's considerable surprise, it raised its hands, fingertips peeping out of its oversized sleeve-like arms, as if asking her not to shoot. "Well," said Fee after a long few seconds, "this is unexpected." The Niroi had no reply. "We can't stand here like this all night," Fee offered. Again, the Niroi had nothing to offer, merely tilted its head the other way, like it was still puzzled about what she was getting at. Very slowly, not entirely certain why she was doing it, Fee uncocked the Webley, gently lowering the hammer and releasing the trigger. Then, still moving without any hurry, she put the weapon away, though she didn't fasten the holster flap. The Niroi remained still for a moment, then lowered its hands. They stood looking at each other some more, and Fee had the laughably fanciful notion that it would have shrugged if it had known the gesture. "I don't suppose you can change a tire," Fee said wryly, gesturing to the flat and the spare. The Niroi hovered a little closer. Fee backed up, hand on holster, but didn't draw her revolver again as the creature? Machine? She'd never been entirely certain what they were. Gave every indication of sizing up the situation. And then, to a level of surprise that made her earlier experience seem mundane, it went around to the front of the Blitz, got its arms underneath the bumper, and lifted the front end until the wheels were clear of the ground. Her eyes wide with astonishment, Fee eased closer, considering the situation. She could hear whatever the Niroi used for propulsion thrumming quietly with the effort of holding up the truck, the red hexagons on its striker-like winglets glowing brighter. When she looked at it, it turned its head to regard her with its blank face, then made a little motion that looked for all the world like it was saying, "Well, get on with it, I'm not going to hold this forever." With a laugh at that and the overall surreality of the situation, Fee changed the tire. Once she had the flat removed, the new one in place, and the nuts screwed on, the Niroi let the vehicle down. Fee tightened the nuts fully, double-checked them, and then straightened up and turned to see the Niroi still standing by the front of the truck, giving her that same inscrutable look.
Thanks, she said, not certain what else to say. The Niroi witch raised one of her hands in a slightly shy-seeming little wave, and then, with another faint thrum of whatever drove them, shot away into the nearly dark sky, zooming away to the east. Fee was still standing there by the truck 10 minutes later, looking up into the now starry sky, when Eleanor Hutchins swooped down and alighted nearby. "Having a little trouble, Fee?" Eleanor inquired, and then, as she moved closer and saw the look on her wingmate's face, "Are you all right? What happened?" Fee blinked, tore her eyes away from the sky, and turned to Eleanor.
I have no idea, she said.
Saturday, June 8th. Now hear this. All witches report to the shooting range. Repeat, all witches, please report to the shooting range immediately. Thank you. Curious, the 501st's witches did as requested, to find Griffin and Chris Barkhorn waiting for them, both sporting lab coats over their clothes and looking quite pleased with themselves. Chris was wearing an angular metal backpack that put some of the veterans in mind of the bulky pre-Miyafuji magic engines that had powered Stryker units until the late 30s. Both had on what looked like welding goggles, pushed up on their foreheads. Ladies, thanks for coming, said Griffin with a smile. We've got something to show you. I think you're going to like it. He went to the folding table set up in front of the viewing area, and, with a dramatic flourish, whipped a drop cloth away to reveal the item beneath. Behold, he said, and picked up... Well, no one was really sure what it was. It was roughly rifle-shaped, about the size of an MG-42 in its aerial configuration. In fact, many of those present could tell from the shape that the chassis it was based on, and the wooden furniture, were from an MG-42. Where the machine gun would have had its ammunition drums, interchangeable barrel assembly, and so forth, though, the inner workings of this one seemed to be made from radio parts and plumbing supplies, culminating in what looked like the Yagi antenna from an FUG-202 short-range aerial radar set. This, my friends, is a Tesla Dyne Heavy Industries Model 1939 Mark 1A2 Infantry Portable Particle Beam Accelerator, adapted for magical enhancement with a Type 17 Miyafuji device and fitted with an MG-42 Field Expedient Operator Interface, Griffin explained, hefting the weapon. It's tuned to require a level of magical input comparable to the demands of typical air infantry weapons, such as the 42 and the Type 99 autocannon. With that input, he went on, it's capable of up to 5 seconds at a sustained output of approximately 40 kilowatts, with minimal beam deflection to an effective range in excess of 300 meters, before its primary energy source is exhausted and must be replaced. He snapped open a panel on the side of the weapon and tapped the stubby yellow cylinder inside with a fingertip, then closed it again. By default, the trigger mechanism is configured to meter that output in 250 millisecond bursts, for an effective ammunition capacity of 20 rounds before reload. I can tell, he said with a smile and a slightly theatrical raised finger, that you're not sure what all of that means in the real world. Therefore. He turned, went to Chris, who had settled her goggles over her eyes while he spoke, and handed her the weapon, then turned back to the gallery as she readied it and went on, My lovely assistant Christian will now demonstrate. With her usual cheerful smile, Chris connected the weapon to the backpack she wore with a fat, braided metal-covered cable, then called forth her magic. As her familiar's tail and ears appeared, the backpack emitted the characteristic low whine of a pre-Miyafuji magic engine powering up, and dark slots along the upper structure of the weapon began to glow. The backpack and cable are only for demonstration purposes, Griffin explained. Operationally, it would be driven by short-range broadcast takeoff from your Stryker's Miyafuji engine, as normal. He turned back to Chris. Ready? Chris raised the weapon, settling its stock against her shoulder, and nodded. Ready. Griffin consulted a reading on one of the gauges on the side of her magic engine pack, then flipped his own goggles down, stepped back, and declared, Begin. Her smile becoming a slightly fierce little grin, Chris thumbed up the little pop-up sight on top of the weapon, borrowed from a Fuso Type 99, took aim at the first of the targets standing at the far end of the range, and squeezed the trigger.
Instead of a gun's report, the sound the weapon made was more like a peal of thunder, part crack, part boom. Rather than a bullet, what emerged from the antenna at the end of the weapon was a bolt of bright blue-white light, there and gone so fast it left only a streaky afterimage, and the target was gone. Within moments, so was the next one, and the next. With quick, machine-like precision that reminded many onlookers of her elder sister's methods, Chris dispatched the full complement of 20 shots, taking out additional targets as they popped up or swung out from cover at various points around the range. Once the weapon's power supply ran dry, she opened the panel on the side of the weapon Griffin had shown earlier, took a second yellow cylinder from a pouch at her belt, and pushed it smartly into the workings. It displaced the one that was already there, popping it out through a spring-hinged port on the other side of the receiver to fall smoking to the ground. That job done, she closed the loading port, set the safety, and raised the weapon out of firing position, declaring, "Demonstration complete." Turning back to his slightly dumbfounded observers, Griffin said, "The full name is a bit cumbersome, so you can see why we like to call it the lightning rifle." There was a momentary silence. "Oh, I like that," said Shirley. Monday, June 10th. Paris, Orly Airport. Erica Hartman stood for almost a full minute, silently regarding the view out of the Orly terminal building windows, before turning to the person next to her and saying, "Check me on this. Is that airplane much closer than I think it is, or is it in fact gigantic?" Francesca Lucchini took a long, hard look out the window, then nodded. "It's gigantic." "That's what I thought," Erica said. Gertrude Barkhorn shook her head, arms folded. "Only the Liberians." "It's actually worse than that," said an amused-sounding man's voice from behind the little group of witches. They turned to see a black-haired man in the uniform of a Liberian Army Air Force captain, complete with a sheepskin bomber jacket that put many of them in mind of Griffin's, grinning at them. "That aircraft's from Texas," he said, nodding toward the window. "Everything's bigger there." Shirley made a scoffing sound. "If you believe Texans," she said. "Well, ma'am, I'm from Oklahoma, so I don't make a habit of that myself," said the man with a wry smile. "But it's hard to argue when you see the 36 with your own eyes." He stuck out a hand. "Jack Ridley, 8th AAF Test Command." "Charlotte Yeager, 501st JFW, Shirley replied, giving his offered hand a pump. "Call me Shirley." She introduced her colleagues, then asked, "We were just on our way to get something to eat. It's a long flight from Rivovillet. Why don't you join us?" "Can you tell us anything more about that monster?" Erica wondered. "I can do better than that on both accounts," Ridley said. "I'm the engineering liaison officer on the project. Come on out and I'll give you the tour. We can rustle up some grub Air Force style while we're at it." Upstairs, in a large office with an even more commanding view of the apron, Mina stood looking down at the vast, gleaming shape parked down there, then turned to the man whose office it was and said, "Impressive, but I'm not sure why I'm seeing it." Major General Curtis LeMay finished lighting a cigar, then said, "You're seeing it because Ike wants you to see it. He can't be here today. He's stuck in London. So he passed the job on to me." Mina made no comment in response to that. Nor did von Hammer, nor the top two officers of the 501st, all of whom were present for the meeting. LeMay didn't seem to be expecting one. Stepping to the window, he gestured to the parked aircraft and said,
You're looking at the prototype Convair XB36. 6 3,000 horsepower radial engines, fully pressurized, crew of 7. It's 162 feet long with a wingspan of 230 feet, the largest aircraft in the world, and it has the longest range. That aircraft just flew in from the USL, and if it had to, it could turn around and fly right back again without refueling.
Hmm, said Mio noncommittally. But what's it for?
Well, when we started work on it in 41, it wasn't clear whether any place in Europe was going to be able to hold out against the Nuroi, LeMay said. If nobody could, if Europe fell, we had to have an aircraft that could strike targets over there from the Liberian mainland and make it home again. As you can imagine, that was a significant engineering challenge. Nothing existed at that time that could come anywhere near that. It's taken 5 years, and I don't even want to know how many millions of dollars. But there it is.
That is impressive, said Perrine Klosterman. Then, turning away from the window to meet the general's eyes, she went uncompromisingly on. And completely useless. Not only hasn't Europe fallen, quite the opposite, in fact, a conventional bombardment aeroplane is utterly pointless against the Nuroi. You say it could attack a target in Europe from the U.S. and then fly home again. I think we all know what would actually happen is that it would get from the U.S. to the general vicinity of its target, and then the Nuroi would eat it.
Ordinarily, I'd agree with you, LeMay said, but you don't know the whole story. The B-36 isn't designed to carry just bombs. Its weapons base can also be configured to carry striker units, and there's room in the crew accommodations on board for their operators. It's a flying witchcraft carrier.
Unable to keep a slightly smug little smile off his face at having outmaneuvered the Galleon's objection, he put a hand against the window and said, "We call it the Peacemaker."
Chateau St. Ulrich. So, said Francie Whittle over the Meteor's starboard winglet, when are you going to show me your secret toy box?
I beg your pardon? Ursula wondered, looking up from the Stryker's open engine pod.
Your workshop, said Whittle, tilting her head toward fuel storage. That's where your Liberian boffin does his weapons development, yes? I saw him and the Barkhorn girl come out of there with their death ray the other day, and I know you keep your tools in there. Stands to reason that's where all the interesting things happen.
Seeing that Ursula was unconvinced, she went on, Look, I'm cleared up to most secret, and I don't work for anybody but the Royal Aircraft Establishment. My interest is purely technical. And I know you must have some good stuff in there from the way your face is going pink, she added mischievously.
Ursula regarded her for a moment, then sighed.
All right, come and see.
Orly. Aboard the prototype, Shirley, Lucchini, Erica, and Truda were duly impressed. The sheer immensity of the thing was even more pronounced on the inside. Everything seemed like it was too far away from everything else to be in a single airplane. And apart from the curvature of the walls, the compartments gave little impression of where they were. They felt more like rooms in some sort of long, narrow building. The forward cabin, in particular, with its glass-domed terrarium, was more like some sort of scientific observatory than the business end of an airplane, with the flight deck up above like a sort of loft.
No armaments? Truda wondered as Ridley showed them around.
The Liberian engineer shook his head.
No point, he said. The original design called for a bunch of remote-operated turrets, but you and I both know that against the Nuroi, normal machine guns are about as useful as tits on a boar.
Seeming to realize he'd said that out loud, he reddened slightly and added,
as it were. Sorry, ma'am.
I've heard worse, Truda said dryly, making Erica giggle.
So we decided to save weight and leave him at home.
Ridley went on, grateful for the free pass. They clambered through an access hatch and into the after compartment, where the most obvious feature was an assortment of narrow but serviceable bunks, and he added, "Also, no guns means no gunners, so that's six guys we don't have to carry. Useful if we've got all the bays set up for strikers. Our full complement's a dozen, and we can't expect their pilots to just stay saddled up the whole time. Not when this beast can be out for up to 40 hours at a time."
"How considerate," said Shirley. Then, looking around, she went on, "Looks like it'd still be pretty cramped."
"Well, in a situation like that, the boys up front would have to sleep in their seats," Ridley explained. "The more likely scenario would be half bombs, half strikers. Half a dozen witches sleeping in shifts. It wouldn't be a weekend at the Waldorf, but it'd do for war operations."
Truda, ever practical, nodded. "Then the witches serve as escorts and use the plane as a mobile base of operations. Makes sense."
"Somebody said something about food," said Lucchini, and Ridley laughed.
"Right this way," he said, leading the group toward the hatch leading out of the back of the bunk room.
Chateau St. Ulrich. Ursula was expecting one of a fairly limited set of reactions to showing Whittle the HE-162 jetpack, but Whittle produced none of them. Instead, bending down to have a look at the jetpack's tailpipe, she declared, "Oh, you Teutonic buggers, you've done it to me again."
"Pardon?" said Ursula, bemused.
Whittle pointed at the pack with the stem of her unlit pipe and said, "First this von Ohain chappie comes up with a concept very much not unlike the turbojet, all unbeknownst to me, and now this. Is this reheat?"
Ursula looked.
"It's, well, Nachbrenner. It doesn't have an English name. I suppose you would translate it afterburner."
"Injects fuel into the exhaust to increase thrust, yes?" Whittle asked.
"Yes," Ursula said.
"Von Ohain again?"
Ursula shook her head.
"No, Nachbrenner is my own invention."
Whittle threw up her hands.
"I give up. I just give... wait."
She looked at the jetpack again, then eyed Ursula skeptically.
"What the devil is this even for? Only someone who can use magic would be able to fly it without being almost immediately killed to death. And at that point, why not just use a bloody striker?"
"Well," said a man's voice equably from behind her, "A, they don't come in my size, and B, nobody wants to see that."
"On a point of order,"
Sonya, Jutulainen, and Litviak murmured from the doorway behind them, causing Ayla to blink and give her a "do what now?" sort of look. Whittle missed the byplay, and Ursula's giggle at it. Being too busy jumping in such a violent start, she nearly knocked the jetpack off its stand.
"What the—"
she blurted, whirling. "Sorry," said Griffin. "I don't know how I do that. It's not like I'm in any way unobtrusive." Putting out a hand, he introduced himself, then said, "It's a real honor. I'm a big fan of your work."
"Thank you," said Whittle automatically, and then, "Do you mean to tell me you fly this thing?"
Griffin nodded. "I sure do."
"You're a man."
"I'm aware of that."
"Men can't fly. I mean, that's such an axiom, it's a figure of speech. When men fly."
"Oink," said Griffin impassively.
"I beg your pardon," Whittle replied.
"What's up in here?" Ayla wondered. Griffin turned to her with a smile. "Group Captain Whittle doesn't believe I can fly," he said.
"Oh, really?" said Ayla, grinning.
"Sounds like it's time to roll out the tiger moth, then." Or Lee.
"All right, I can see how that might work," Mina agreed.
considering the operational outline LeMay had just given her of what Chafe envisioned for the B-36. It doesn't really need that colossal range if it's to operate from bases in Europe, but, well, better too much than too little, I suppose.
That's always been my general operating philosophy, said LeMay. Behind him, Mio and Mina exchanged a silent little, "I'll bet it has," glance, but said nothing.
"At any rate, General," LeMay went on, "that's what Ike wanted you to see. The XB-36 is in theater for testing for the next few weeks, and for some of that testing we're going to need some witches. Your wing has a dedicated flight test squadron, so you're the obvious choice. Chafe will be in touch as the timetable takes shape."
"What do you think?" Mio wondered as the four of them walked down the hall toward the exit.
"I see the possibilities," Mina said. "It's worth looking into, and I think we can expect a fair assessment. Say what you like about General LeMay, he's not against witches as an operational reality."
"He just seems to dislike most of us personally," Perrine deadpanned, making Mio grin and nudge her shoulder.
"Maybe someone should tell him that our dedicated flight test squadron consists of two engineers, a mad Englishwoman, and a madder Polonian," said Von Hammer with a tiny smile.
"What he doesn't know won't hurt him," said Mina. "We may need to second a few people to the squadron for the testing, but we can deal with that when the time comes."
"Ah," said a voice from a doorway off to the right, and then the rangy figure of LeMay's aide, Captain Blaskovich, emerged to greet them.
"Good, I caught you before you could leave. I've got some information that you're not going to like, but you need to know it."
"Uh-oh," said Mio as the four witches halted.
"What is it?"
"Our mutual friends Reichenberg and Skorzeny have been spotted," Blaskovich told them. "As you suspected, Rittmeister von Hammer, they're together. But you'll never guess where."
"Where?" Mina asked.
"The Hibernian Highlands? Azatlan? Formosa?" Blaskovich smiled, though it was not the kind of smile that said its wearer found anything funny.
"Monte Carlo," he said.
Perrine frowned.
"Monte Carlo? That means they've barely even left Gallia. What on earth are they doing there?"
"That's the best part," said Blaskovich. "What does anybody do in Monte Carlo?"
"Gamble," said Mio.
"Drink," Perrine suggested.
"Avoid paying taxes," said Von Hammer wryly.
"All of the above," said Blaskovich. "Well, Skorzeny isn't gambling, but Reichenberg's been running the table at Baccarat every night in the casino lately, and Britannian intelligence tells us he wins more than he loses."
"That's strange," Von Hammer mused. "Out of character. Reichenberg isn't the gambling type."
"He doesn't seem to be doing it for pleasure," Blaskovich informed her. "He wants money, and lots of it, and that's how he's decided to get it. So far, though, we don't have any idea what for."
"If you know where he is, why doesn't someone go and arrest him?" wondered Mio. But Blaskovich shook his head.
"Monaco's neutral territory," he said. "Chafe's military police don't have any jurisdiction there. We send in armed personnel to grab him and Skorzeny. That's an act of war."
"So?" Mio inquired bluntly. "How many divisions has the Prince of Monaco got?"
Blaskovich laughed.
"I like the way you think, Colonel, but unfortunately cooler heads have prevailed," he said. "For now, the word is we watch and wait while MI6 tries to figure out what the hell they're up to. I just thought you ladies would like to know."
"Thank you, Captain," said Mina.
"If the time comes for more direct action, and you think we in the 501st can be of any help, just let us know. I'm sure any number of us would be eager to help," she added with a slightly predatory smile.
"I will bear that in mind, ma'am," said Blaskovich, saluting. "You have a safe flight back up north now."
Chateau St. Ulrich. Back up north, someone else had just completed a safe flight. Climbing down from the 501st's Tiger Moth support aircraft, Francie Whittle pulled off her borrowed flying helmet, handed it to a mischievously grinning Ayla in the pilot's seat, and then turned to Griffin, who was in the process of unstrapping from the gently pinging HE-162.
"I stand corrected, Captain Hutchins," she said with great dignity.
Tuesday, June 11th, 18:30 hours, Chateau St. Ulrich. Through the years that the 501st JFW had fought together, several traditions had formed. Major holidays were recognized, combat operations permitting. Lucchini sleeps wherever she wants. And most importantly, where possible, they would work with their fellow witches in neighboring units to arrange for coverage to allow the entire wing, including their night witches, to celebrate birthdays together. Tonight, that meant that Sonia and Haida Marie were both looking forward to an evening spent with their friends as they gathered to celebrate Lynn Bishop's 17th birthday. With Wilma sitting beside her at the long dining table and an open chair for her wife left open on her right, Lynn awaited the evening's repast. Earlier on, she had been given firm instructions that she was not to cook dinner or bake her own birthday cake. Instead, she'd decided to spend a bit of her day to sew a new tea dress for herself from some lovely saffron-colored fabric she'd found on her last visit to town. "You know," Wilma joked, "you're supposed to get us to get you birthday presents." Lynn blushed at that, but recovered quickly when she'd been assured the dress was quite lovely by her friends. Dinner that evening, provided by Yoshka, Griffin, and Christian Barkhorn, was a rather Britannian affair in honor of the occasion. Beef Wellington, slices of hominy pie, and mushy peas for the main course, followed by the presentation of a gigantic raspberry custard trifle for dessert, accompanied by several bottles of the local Riesling. Happily stuffed full, the assembled witches retired to the living room, where music and cards had been laid on by Erica Hartman. "It's kind of funny," Ayla observed to the birthday girl as they sat down to a round of bridge with Truda and Francie Whittle. "You and Wilma have your birthdays so close together. And isn't your younger sister Sintima Paivai in May, too?" Wilma snickered, overhearing the question. "Yep, Darjeeling's is about halfway between us on May 28th. Giving her younger sister a sly look, she continued, "Our mom always seemed to get the most out of September." Making a show of examining her hand of cards, Lynn mumbled something that was probably the start of, "I couldn't possibly comment," but was saved by Yoshka interrupting the start of bidding to lean in and deliver an impressively long kiss to the cheers and applause of the room. As the evening wound down, many of the witches left for their bedrooms in ones and twos, until Mio, Mina, Hattori, Griffin, and Von Hammer were the last ones left, enjoying the last bottle of wine that had been opened in some cases, and the last scoops of trifle for others. "I love the nights like this," Mina said, happily sipping at her wine on one of the living room's chaises longues next to her fiancé. "It's important to have something normal now and then." "Mmm," Mio agreed after finishing a bite of jam-soaked pound cake. "You can't forget the war, but it's good to put it aside for a little bit and just be happy." Putting her hand over Mina's, Mio looked over to where Hattori was just finishing filling a dish with berries and custard. "Speaking of which, Shizuka?" Hattori straightened slightly, but either the informal address or the wine and dessert she'd already consumed kept her from coming to complete attention. "Yes, Colonel?" "How's the temple project coming along?" "Very well, actually." Hattori sat down in one of the chairs across from her commander,
balancing the dish on her knee. "The frame and roof are done. We're just finishing the interior now. I would think it should be ready within a week."
Mio nodded, obviously having expected as much.
"Well, then."
Looking over to Mina, she squeezed her hand lightly.
"Seems that we have a venue. It's probably time for a date."
Mina squeezed back, her face thoughtful.
"So it is.
With LeMay needing our help in a few weeks. The middle of July? He and his ridiculous bomber ought to be out of our hair by then."
Griffin helpfully went to the calendar hanging on one wall, then flipped to the next month.
"The 12th's a Friday, if you think things will be wrapped up by then."
Mina considered, then nodded.
"I should think so. Mio?"
Sakamoto grinned, then leaned over to give Mina a quick kiss.
"July 12th it is. Hanalora, would you post that in the morning bulletin?"
Funhammer toasted the happy couple, then drained her glass.
"Happily. I'll go make the notice up now, I think, then head for bed."
"Excellent. Thank you."
Funhammer stood, then set her glass down before deciding to pick up what was left of the bottle of wine with a slight smirk.
"This should help as well. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen."
Saluting them all with the bottle, Funhammer left the room, humming the Braut lead as she disappeared down the hallway. 2340 hours. Drafting the wedding date announcement for the 501st, and sending less obviously worded notices to be telexed to several interested parties without arousing the interest of busybodies in the radio shacks, took Hannelore Funhammer very little time, so she decided to tackle a few other matters in her office before turning in, particularly with the aid of the remaining wine. Filing a few matters for Mina's attention, signing off on several forms, and offering a few choice words for several rather foolish inquiries from the rear echelon, she was about to consider things finished when she noticed a red and blue-edged envelope that had managed to hide itself at the bottom of her inbox. Her eyes widened as she read the address. The envelope was addressed personally to her, and the return was handwritten, but instead of a postage stamp, it simply bore the imperial seal.
"Was ist das, Fritchen?"
Slitting the envelope, she began to read the letter as she stood next to her desk. No one else was in the castle's administrative wing at this hour, so there was no one to hear the sound, a few moments later, of a wine bottle shattering as it hit the floor. Nor would anyone hear the sound of Hannelore Funhammer weeping, or the words that escaped her office door between the tears.
"Sie verdammt Narr! Hätte ich gesagt ja!"